All right, so are you ready to jump back into Jacob's story?
Oh, yeah.
You know, we left off with that wrestling match with God and the new name
All
Israel,
right.
but this new identity, it kind of gets tested as he leads his family. And let's just say things get messy.
Well, you've given us some really interesting material here.
Yeah.
Chapters 34 through 37 of Genesis.
Right.
It's like this bridge between Jacob's generation and his sons.
Yeah, and it sets up so much of what we'll see in the Joseph story later.
Absolutely. The ripple effects of Jacob's past and the seeds of what's to come.
Okay, so first up, the Dinah situation in Shechem.
Oh yeah, this is a tough one, but definitely important.
It is, and I don't even know how to like ease into this, but Dinah, Jacob's daughter, she's assaulted by Shechem.
Right, and the son of the local ruler, no less.
Right, and the text doesn't shy away from the horror of it.
Not at all. It's a
You know?
violation, a complete violation of her personhood.
And it's not just some cultural misunderstanding.
No, this is brutal, and it sets off a chain of events that are just tragic.
And you know what got me was Jacob's reaction.
Or lack of reaction.
Exactly. He just kind of sits on it until his sons come back.
Yeah, it's passive, almost like he's frozen.
Right.
And you have to wonder, does this go back to his own history with deception? Is he afraid to stir up trouble, or maybe something else is going on? But whatever the reason, his silence, it speaks volumes.
He really does.
Yeah.
And when the sons do find out, their reaction is, well, extreme.
Oh, yeah, they go from 0 to 100 real quick.
Right. And their plan is shocking. They'll agree to intermarriage with the Shechemites, but only if every man gets circumcised.
Right, and that's huge. You have to remember, circumcision wasn't just a ritual,
Right.
it was the sign of the covenant, between God and Abraham,
Okay.
passed down through the generations, a mark of belonging, a physical representation of their spiritual commitment.
So for the sons to use it like this as part of a revenge plot,
It's a perversion of something sacred.
and it gets even worse. Because they use this sacred act as a cover for a massacre.
Yeah, while the men are recovering, Simeon and Levi, they lead this attack.
Right.
They kill every male in the city and plunder their possessions.
It's horrifying.
Absolutely, a brutal act of vengeance.
And leaves you questioning their morals.
For sure, this isn't righteous judgment, it's just pure revenge.
And the crazy thing is, they don't even seem to feel bad about it.
No, they try to justify themselves by saying that Shechem treated Dinah like a prostitute.
Right, like that somehow makes it okay.
And that's where it gets really interesting, because it shows their idea of justice is so messed up.
Yeah.
They're equating this horrific act of violence with a cultural label that was often used to devalue women.
Right.
It's twisted logic. It makes you wonder about their motives.
Okay, so we have Dinah violated Jacob, paralyzed by fear, and the sons committing this brutal act of revenge.
Right.
What does this say about this family at this point?
Honestly, it's a pretty bleak picture. A family fractured by trauma, driven by fear and anger, and struggling to live up to the covenant they claim to represent.
Yeah, and Jacob's response to all of this, it's not exactly heroic.
He's more worried about the fallout for himself than about what his sons have actually done.
Right. He scolds them, not for the killings.
But for making him stink to the Canaanites.
Right. His concern is for his own safety, not the lives lost or the moral decay in his own family.
It's a sad commentary on his leadership.
It really is. Talk about a dysfunctional family dynamic. But then amidst all this darkness, God speaks.
Right. He tells Jacob to go back to Bethel.
Oh, Bethel. This is huge.
Right. This isn't just any random place. It's loaded with meaning.
Right. It's where Jacob had that dream of the ladder to heaven.
Yes, where God reaffirmed his covenant promises.
It's a callback to his roots, a chance for a spiritual reset.
Exactly. A chance to realign himself with God's purpose.
And it seems like Jacob gets it, at least on some level.
Yeah, because before leaving Shechem, he makes his family gather up all their idols and bury them.
That's powerful.
It is, think about it. Idols represent anything we put before God, things we worship, things we trust in more than him. So burying them is like saying, we're done with these false dependencies.
Wow.
We're recommitting to the one true God.
You know, that's an insight I can actually use.
I think we all can.
It makes you think, what idols do I need to bury to experience that kind of spiritual cleansing?
Absolutely. What are the things that distract us from God that keep us from being in a right relationship with Him?
Yeah, what needs to be buried, metaphorically, of course, so that we can truly be free?
It's a great question for all of us.
So Jacob and his family, freshly cleansed of idols, they set out for Bethel.
Yeah, and wouldn't you know it, God shows up big time.
He does. He instills fear in the surrounding towns.
Right, so no one attacks them to get revenge for the Shechem massacre.
It's a clear sign that God is with them.
Absolutely protecting them despite their sin and dysfunction.
And then when they arrive at Bethel, God appears to Jacob again.
He reaffirms those covenant promises we talked about.
Yeah, and he officially changes his name to Israel.
Which is huge. It's not just a name change, it signifies transformation. Remember, Israel means he struggles with God.
Right.
It acknowledges Jacob's past, his wrestling with God and man, and points to his ongoing journey of becoming who God wants him to be.
It's a powerful reminder that even when we mess up, when we're surrounded by brokenness, God is still working in us.
Absolutely. He's still calling us to grow, to become more like him.
And that's encouraging, that even with our flaws, God is faithful.
So important to remember God's grace is bigger than our mistakes.
Right. His love pursues us even when we run away or really mess things up.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've seen some pretty heavy stuff.
We have Dinah's assault, the son's revenge, Jacob's fear-driven response.
But we've also seen glimmers of hope, God's presence, the burying of idols, the reaffirmation of the covenant.
Yes, those glimmers are crucial. They remind us of God's faithfulness.
So where do we go from here?
Well, from here, things take another turn. We're going to see the passing of the older generation, a shocking betrayal within the family, and a glimpse of what's to come in the next phase of God's plan.
Oh, this is getting good. All right, let's dive into it.
So we left off with Jacob back at Bethel, you know, that significant place in his spiritual journey.
Right.
But as we move forward, the focus really starts to shift to the next generation.
And specifically to Joseph.
Exactly. His story is full of, you know, twists and turns and betrayals.
Right.
But ultimately, it's this powerful picture of redemption.
Yeah, Joseph's story is definitely one you can't forget.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like classic drama, you know, sibling rivalry, jealousy, deceit, and of course, a lot of divine intervention.
It has it all.
So where do we even start with this one?
Well, we pick up with Joseph as a young man, the favorite son.
Oh, yeah. And that causes some problems, right?
Well, you know, not exactly a recipe for family harmony.
No kidding.
Yeah.
The text tells us that Jacob loved Joseph more than all his other sons.
Right.
And he even gave him that special coat of many colors.
Yeah. What's up with that coat anyway? It seems like more than just fashion.
Right. What's the significance?
It's definitely symbolic. I mean, on a practical level, it probably shows Joseph's favored status. Maybe even some kind of authority in the family.
Right.
But on a deeper level, I think it represents Jacob's love for Joseph, a love that unfortunately he doesn't really show to his other sons.
And that favoritism, along with Joseph's dreams.
Oh, yeah, those dreams.
They set the stage for some major conflict.
They do. Joseph has these dreams where he's clearly in charge. You know, his brothers, even his parents, they're bowing down to him.
Talk about adding fuel to the fire.
Right. It's like he's waving a red flag in front of a bull.
And it's interesting because these dreams, they're not just random. They're foreshadowing Joseph's future.
Absolutely. God's giving us a sneak peek.
Right. But at this point, they just make things worse between Joseph and his brothers.
They definitely deepen the rift. And that tension just builds and builds until it explodes when Jacob sends Joseph to check on his brothers.
Right. They're out tending the flocks.
Yeah.
You'd think this would be a chance for them to reconnect.
Maybe to patch things up a bit.
But no, they see him coming. And they hatch this plan to get rid of him.
And it's chilling how quickly it escalates. First, they want to kill him.
Wow.
But Reuben, you know, from the Shechem incident, he suggests throwing him in a pit instead.
Okay, so at least one voice of reason.
It seems so. The text says he planned to come back and rescue him.
Oh.
But unfortunately, things don't quite go according to plan.
And that's when Judah steps in with a different idea.
Right. Sell Joseph into slavery.
It's such a moral failure.
It is. Driven by jealousy and greed, they trade their own brother for 20 pieces of silver.
I mean, it's just heartbreaking.
It's a vivid picture of human depravity, but it also sets in motion this chain of events that surprisingly leads to Joseph's rise to power.
Right, and that's what's amazing about this story. God's ability to work through even the most twisted acts.
Absolutely, to bring about his purposes.
Okay, so they sell Joseph to a caravan of Ishmaelites.
Right, and he's taken off to Egypt.
Then they come up with this elaborate lie to cover their tracks.
They take Joseph's coat, dip it in goat blood.
Oh, God.
And tell Jacob that a wild animal must have killed him.
It's just
It adds insult to injury, and Jacob, he's heartbroken. He completely believes them.
It's a reminder of the devastating consequences of sin, not just for the victim.
Right.
But for the whole family.
Those ripple effects, they last for years.
So now Joseph is in Egypt. He's been sold to Potiphar, an official of Pharaoh. Talk about a change of scenery.
A complete upheaval.
He's far from home, stripped of his identity, thrust into this unfamiliar world.
A situation that could easily break someone.
For sure. But what's amazing is that even in this situation, Joseph's character shines through.
He does. He's hardworking and diligent, and he quickly gains Potiphar's trust.
It's like he excels no matter what.
Right. He can't help but be successful. And he rises through the ranks.
Yeah, he becomes the overseer of Potiphar's whole household.
God is preparing him, shaping him for something greater.
But then, just when things are looking up...
We've got another setback.
Courtesy of Potiphar's wife.
Oh, yes, Potiphar's wife. She develops this, you know, unhealthy attraction to Joseph.
And she tries to seduce him.
Repeatedly.
And Joseph, to his credit, he refuses.
Which is incredibly impressive considering the power dynamics at play.
Right. He's risking everything by standing up to her.
He is. It's a testament to his character, his commitment to what's right, even when it's hard.
But that refusal comes at a price.
It does, because she doesn't take rejection well.
Not at all. She accuses him of assault.
And Joseph is thrown into prison.
It's injustice all over again.
It is falsely accused and punished for something he didn't do.
You'd think he'd be completely demoralized.
You would. But even in prison, God's presence is evident.
How so?
Well, Joseph finds favor with the warden.
Okay.
He's given authority, and he even uses his gift for dream interpretation.
Wait, hold on. Dream interpretation. Did we miss something here?
You remember those dreams Joseph had as a young man?
The ones that got him in trouble with his brothers.
Exactly. Well, it seems like those dreams weren't just symbolic. They were revealing a gift.
Wow. Okay. So he uses this gift to help two of Pharaoh's officials who are also in prison.
Right. The cupbearer and the baker.
Word out.
His interpretations are spot on. The cupbearer is restored to his position.
Okay.
But the baker is executed, just like Joseph predicted.
Dinner.
And here's the frustrating part. The cupbearer forgets about Joseph.
Ugh, talk about a letdown.
It is. He's left in prison for two more years.
You think after all that at least someone would help him out?
It's a reminder that even when we experience God's favor, human forgetfulness and brokenness can still cause us pain.
Right.
But that delay, it's not the end of the story.
It's not.
It sets the stage for an even more dramatic turn of events.
Okay. I'm listening.
Pharaoh himself starts having these troubling dreams.
Oh.
And no one in his court can interpret them.
So what happens?
The cupbearer finally remembers Joseph.
He does.
And Joseph is summoned from prison.
Wow.
He's brought before Pharaoh, the most powerful man in Egypt.
Can you imagine the pressure?
It must have been intense. But he stands there, this young Hebrew slave, and with incredible humility and confidence, he interprets the dreams.
What does he say?
He reveals that Egypt will face 7 years of abundance, followed by 7 years of famine.
Whoa, that's a pretty big prediction.
It is. And what's even more impressive is that he doesn't just interpret the dreams. He offers a plan.
A plan for what?
To save Egypt from starvation. He tells Pharaoh to appoint a wise leader to oversee the gathering of grain during the good years.
So he's not just a dream interpreter, he's a strategist.
He's a visionary leader.
And what does Pharaoh do?
Well, he recognizes Joseph's wisdom and God-given insight. He makes a bold decision. He appoints Joseph second in command over all of Egypt.
Wow, talk about a reversal of fortune.
From prisoner to prime minister in an instant.
It's incredible.
It is. This young Hebrew slave, unjustly accused and imprisoned, is now in a position of unprecedented power.
It really does sound like something out of a movie.
It does. But it's not just a feel-good story. It's a testament to God's sovereignty.
Right.
His ability to work through even the most difficult circumstances to accomplish his purposes.
And those purposes are about to become even more clear.
Because guess who shows up in Egypt desperate for food during the famine?
Who?
Joseph's brothers.
No way. The very ones who betrayed him.
The very same.
Talk about an awkward family reunion.
It's a moment full of dramatic irony.
I bet. They have no idea they're standing before their long-lost brother.
And we're going to see how Joseph handles this reunion.
Right.
How he tests his brothers and ultimately reveals his identity.
Oh, man. I can't wait for this. Okay, let's dive into that next part. Okay, so Joseph's brothers are in Egypt, right?
They are.
Desperate for food.
Yep.
Standing before the very brother they betrayed all those years ago.
Oh, what a moment.
Talk about an awkward family reunion. And they have no clue who he is.
None at all. But Joseph, he recognizes them instantly.
Right. So much tension.
So much anticipation. How will he react?
Right. Will he want revenge?
Or will he offer forgiveness and reconciliation?
Well, he doesn't make it easy on them. He puts them through all these tests.
He does.
He accuses them of being spies. Throws them in prison, demands they bring their youngest brother Benjamin back to Egypt as proof of their honesty.
That's a lot.
It is. So what was he trying to do with all this? Was this some kind of power trip?
I don't think so. Remember, Joseph's been through a lot.
Right. Betrayal, enslavement, imprisonment.
It's a long list. These tests, I think it's a way for him to see if his brothers have changed.
Okay.
Have they learned from their mistakes? Are they even capable of remorse and brotherly love?
Yeah, like he's giving them a chance to prove they're not the same guys who threw him in that pit.
Exactly. But it's also a huge risk.
What do you mean?
What if they fail the test? What if they abandon Benjamin just like they abandoned him?
Yeah, what if?
It's a possibility. But I also think there's this deep longing for reconciliation in Joseph. He wants to know if they can be a family again.
Right. And it's not just about his personal feelings, is it?
No, it's bigger than that. His decisions impact so many people, not just his family.
Because he's in a position of power.
Exactly. His choices affect the fate of Egypt and all the surrounding nations during this famine.
So his leadership really matters.
Absolutely. And how he handles the situation with his brothers, it'll reveal a lot about the kind of leader he is, the kind of man he's become.
Okay, so the brothers go back to Canaan to get Benjamin.
Right.
And when they return to Egypt, Joseph keeps testing them.
Oh, yeah. He even plants a silver cup in Benjamin's bag and then accuses him of stealing it.
Whoa, that's intense.
It is. The ultimate test. Will they protect their younger brother or abandon him like they did Joseph?
So what happens?
Well, this is where Judah steps up.
The same Judah who suggested selling Joseph into slavery.
The very one.
What does he do?
He pleads with Joseph to spare Benjamin. He even offers himself as a slave in Benjamin's place.
Wow.
It's a moment of complete transformation for him.
Right.
He's not that selfish, jealous brother anymore. He's willing to sacrifice himself for his family.
That's powerful.
It really is. It shows true brotherly love. And Joseph, seeing this genuine act of selflessness, he can't hold it in any longer.
So he reveals his identity.
He does. It's one of the most emotional scenes in the whole Bible.
Oh, I can imagine. The shock, the guilt, the... just everything.
It's a moment of reckoning for sure, but also a moment of grace.
How so?
Joseph tells his brothers that he doesn't blame them.
Really?
He even says that God used their evil actions for good.
What?
That God orchestrated everything to bring him to Egypt so he could save lives during the famine.
It's amazing how God works.
It is bringing good out of evil. It's a reminder that no matter how far we stray, God's love can heal and restore us.
That's such a powerful message of hope.
It is. And the story doesn't end there.
It doesn't.
Joseph invites his whole family to come live in Egypt. He gives them land and food. They're reunited. Their broken relationships are mended, and they thrive under Joseph's leadership.
It's a beautiful picture of God's faithfulness.
To his promises. Not just to Jacob, but to his descendants, too.
This is the family line that leads to Moses and the Exodus and the nation of Israel.
It all starts here.
So Joseph's story, it points to something much bigger than himself.
It does. It foreshadows the ultimate story of redemption through Jesus.
Whoa, how so?
Well, just as Joseph was betrayed and sold into slavery, Jesus, the perfect Son of God, was betrayed and handed over to death.
Right.
But through Joseph's suffering, many were saved from physical death. And through Jesus' sacrifice, all who believe are offered eternal life.
It's like Joseph's story is a miniature gospel.
A glimpse of God's plan of redemption unfolding.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Jacob's journey and this amazing story of Joseph, what are some key takeaways for our listeners?
I think it challenges us to look at our own lives, our relationships.
Yeah.
Are we holding on to bitterness, or are we willing to forgive, to reconcile, to have a fresh start?
And it reminds us that God can work through anything, even our failures.
Absolutely. It's a story of hope, of redemption, of God's unwavering faithfulness.
It really is. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the book of Genesis. We'll be back soon to explore more fascinating stories and uncover the hidden treasures within God's Word.